This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Hezrul Ashraf. Today's interview is quite special because I'm speaking to you from Parliament. I'm actually sitting in the office of our first woman deputy speaker of the Dewan Rakyat, YB Datuk Sri Azlina Othman Said. She's also the Pengerang MP. And I thought I'd catch up with her to get her thoughts on her time as deputy speaker so far, what that's been like. And my interview with her today in Parliament is especially significant as the Dewan has been out of session to the dismay of many lawmakers and Malaysians. Datuk Sri, thanks so much for having me here in Parliament and for speaking with me and having me in your office today.
Thank you, Hezrul, for inviting me, and salam Ramadan to all the listeners out there.
And salam Ramadan to you too, of course.
Thank you.
So you've been Deputy Speaker, Datuk Sri, for at least 9 months now. You've made history by being the first woman to hold the position. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
What's that been like?
I always get this question. I don't know whether everyone asks if it's a man who's a Deputy Speaker. But if everyone ever asks me what's my biggest challenge, is that my biggest challenge is that within the time that you're sitting up there, it's very difficult to get to the toilet because of the procedure and such. Unlike if you're a judge, you could just stand down the matter and then leave for a while. That's quite a big challenge for me. That's the hilarious part. And especially when the sitting was going on for these few months, if you can recall, we had this, because of the COVID and the barriers, it's quite hilarious because you have to really space them out. And the system that we have that I've been telling the speaker is that it should be more of an efficient system that can pick up voice to text. Because one of the problems is that when you want to hear exactly what they say, especially when they're arguing, and you know, because we are a very multiracial society and we're not like for example, in the British Parliament, you know, they speak English. And it could be the Queen's English or their own Scottish English. But the point here is that it's there, but here, the lingo itself. So it gets very difficult to really, really listen. So that's why you need a lot of time to be very, very careful if you want to make a ruling. So one of the challenges that I believe that the immediate changes that the Parliament must do, it should be a voice to text. On the spot, rather than it take a few days, because in the heat of argument to make a decision. I consider those are the housekeeping challenges, yeah.
Do the arguments concern you? Or do you think those are just part of, you know, being an MP? I mean, is there a limit when an MP crosses a line where you think sometimes people go too far?
I think social media, it could be an enabling factor, because people are watching you live. I think years ago in Parliament, you know, it gets recorded or maybe it's just a voiceover. I think for a lot of voters out there, they want their MPs to be performing. Whether the MP is performing based on issue base or the way he's carrying himself. So to want to have that attention, you know, and wanting to get the voters or the public to respond, I think social media plays a lot of role, and especially now as you go on live, there are a lot of viewers coming in with their own interpretation. Yeah. So maybe that is encouraging more debate for various reasons. But nevertheless, unfortunately for me, the one that I find for being an MP for 4 term is the timing of the debate itself. You know? Because usually for me, I believe that we must allow the MPs to speak. And it's very important to speak because you're representing your constituency. But if you limit the MPs, because you want to settle the matter. But at the same time, if time is given too long, you may get an MP who's taking a platform just to speak for the sake of speaking and not really coming to any important debate point. Because of that, I believe that there must be a balance. I would have more sitting sessions. But in our system, that the sessions are fixed on a certain time frame. That is some of the challenge. Then the other challenge during COVID is the fact that what I face personally is that when the ministers or deputy ministers are not there, I think I did make a ruling the other day. I mean, of course, some were not very happy, but the finance minister was quite chill about it. You know, he explained to me. I said to him, look, you have 2 deputies. And my biggest concern, there must be one in the room, in the chamber, so that at least the MPs, you know, when the MPs prepare their debate, it takes a long time for research. And within that few minutes that they have given, you know, they need to really really, really raise their concerns. And I think we have to respect the MP, regardless of opposition or pro-government, by listening to them and allowing them to speak. Because if we find that that's not important enough, then the question should just be online. But because it is a chamber time, and that's when everyone's debating on it, I always believe in this thing in Israel. To be a politician, not only you can hit, but you must also be able to take the hit. So you can't be hitting in your debate point and you don't want to take the hit. You know? You're like, oh, you know, I must always be the best and you must always say that I'm so great. No, you can't do that. You must allow people to have an opinion, because that's what democracy is all about. See, you may agree, you may disagree, but I always believe that, you know, right to agree and right to disagree is the whole process of what civilization or even democracy is all about. So I have no problem with that. And I believe that if you want to be a politician, that should be the first rule. If not, then, you know, might as well just go on the profession and nobody's going to criticize you.
Hmm. Did you ever expect to become deputy speaker? I mean, was this ever a goal? Was this ever part of the plan? I mean, you've been an MP for, you know, around 20 years, your fourth term now.
Of course not, because my immediate love for being a parliamentarian is to be able to debate. Being a deputy speaker, you can't debate because you're like becoming like an empire up there, and it's quite hard for an empire to speak.
Yeah. You have to be neutral.
You have to be neutral, so-called, right? But the point I'm saying is I personally believe that if you look, we did study, and it's proven that some deputy speakers in some countries are able to debate. Because it's a very technical requirement, because the speaker is supposed to be neutral, but not the deputy speakers, because we are being voted in by us being an MP. It's a seat of by virtue of an MP. And I did raise to the speaker that some debate point that I would like to go down in debate. He says, sure, the speaker is quite open with that. I was about to, I think one of the things that I personally was quite affected was IPCMC. Because when Pakatan Harapan was government, I was involved in the committee.
The police commission.
The police commission, whereby my learned friend, YB Ram Kapal, was the chair. I was representing my party. We were going around meeting the police association, police personnel, you know. And when the government moved the agenda from Pakatan Harapan to Perikatan on this issue, mm-hmm. and it was on the table, you know, I wanted to debate on it, and I did inform the Minister of Home Affairs that I will debate on it, because I was part and parcel of the view of my party and my coalition, which is Barisan Nasional and UMNO then. So I wanted to, but you know, the earlier session was that they withdrew the bill, and then it came in again, and I was also prepared. So from doing my research, I realized that the deputy speaker can speak, can debate when it affects his or her constituency. And maybe when Parliament is open, you'll see me more on the floor then.
Now, walk us through your responsibilities as Deputy Speaker. What have you been focused on over the past year? And what are you focusing on right now, especially since Parliament has been out of session?
I suppose I can quote Winston Churchill when he says the duties of an MP. And the first duty of a Member of Parliament is to do what he thinks in his faithful and disinterested judgment is the right and necessary for the honour and safety of the country. His seasonal duties to his constituency, of whom he is the representative. And we also know the fact that, the balance between party politics, constituencies, duties, and the job or the tasking. But I always believe the first entry point is your responsibility in your job to your voters, to your constituency. The rest are all trimmings. The seat of a minister, deputy minister, all secondary. The source of power comes from your constituency. So, of course, that is where I put in a lot of emphasization on my constituency. With or without parliament sitting, I'm still back. I try my very best to go back. It takes me almost 3.5 hours or 4 hours to go back. I'm at the southern of the south, which is the nearest to Singapore. So I'm like really at the tip of the south. So I'm not as lucky as some people who can just, hop in and half an hour and you're in multiple programs. It's a long journey every week. I try to make it doing programs. If you ask me, the work stays the same. And the only time when you are in the parliament session whereby you are becoming the so-called empire in the in the chamber. But pending all that, there are a few interviews or in usual circumstances, you'll be traveling a lot for international talks and international relations when it comes to parliamentary democracy. And then now, with the select committee, whereby I am chair of one of the select committee, although select committee cannot formally be conducted, but to continue on some of the conversation, to be monitoring the government's work or policy, then going back to bipartisan entities like the APPGM, where I'm the chair for the prison reform. Chiori is the secretariat, and we're working with the prisons department, working with the Ministry of Home Affairs. So those are the days, besides a weekly management meeting with the speaker, as and when I'm available. And also being a political Supreme Council member in my party. And also now I've been given the chairperson for the legal task force for Barisan Nasional. So I try to keep myself busy, yeah.
Why is prison reform important to you? And when you talk about prison reform, right, what do you mean? Are you talking about overcrowding?
Of course, the whole world knows that, you know, it's always overcrowding. But I think COVID has proven a point which is very, very clear, that it is a source where the infection comes in and it stays there. And this is why I think the government is also recognizing that we have to move the agenda. Because the kind of prisoners out there, because we don't privatize our prison system. Some countries do, some countries don't. Some people believe that it's a way out, some people don't. But the point here is that it is overcrowding. And some of the prisons, when we've been briefed, have been designed, been built way back in the 40s, in
old.
The 50s, very old. The system doesn't pick. And then this is the requirement of medical needs. But of course, there's some criticism coming in, say, well, in the prison's not supposed to be a Shangri-La, right? Prison's supposed to be a place of punishment. But the concept of punishment now is changing. The whole world is looking into it. When you put someone in prison, because we don't have separate crimes for separate prisons. Mm. Everybody is roped into one. And that causes a lot of spillover effect. And it's a domino effect also. And you know, between hardcore criminals and between certain petty criminals or petty crime who are unable to settle their bail. So there's a lot of variables. And I think government must be very serious to look into overcrowding. So there must be a very, because I'm quite grateful that the government is also responding quite positively, not stopping the APPGM to meet government agencies or certain, like the prisons department, to sit down and figure a way to look into a new approach. You know, that is the response that we get, which is quite good. And especially with the king himself, I've been told he's quite concerned about the overcrowding. So that's a positive sign.
Are there any parliamentary reforms that you're hoping to see through that are either new or from the previous Pakatan Harapan government? I know, for instance, that, you know, there's been a lot of push for strengthening parliament as an institution, strengthening our public institutions in general, right? What's going on that front?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenge, or for me, that I would like to see is the consistency of making parliament independent. And to make parliament independent is that the Parliament Services Act must be brought back. Why? It's because of the fact that, in some countries, when you talk about independence, it means you have your own coffers, which is you have your own budget and you make decisions for your budget. But if the government or the ruling government is controlling that, then you can imply government's been controlled. So if you want to dismiss that presumption, you must allow it to be independent. One of my challenges when I was a law minister at the previous government was the parliamentary draftsmen. In most parliament, the parliamentary draftsmen are internally belonging to the parliament, because the parliamentary draftsman or draftswoman is able to evaluate laws being drafted by the Attorney General's chambers with the legal department or all the ministries.
And are they MPs necessarily?
No. These are supposedly independent experts. Hmm. What we have right now is that the parliamentary draftman belongs to the Attorney General chambers. So when you belong to one institution, right, whereby the legal advisor of the ministry is from the Attorney General chambers, the prosecutors from the Attorney General's chambers, the parliamentary draftsmen from the chambers, what happens is that you have a internal musical chair. So one person can move to another department. Okay, now that's one challenge. The other challenge is the outcome of drafting. Now, one of the things that I faced when I was a law minister is some laws I drafted myself. And I just asked the parliamentary draftman from the Attorney General's Chambers to evaluate or to guide me. But the content itself comes from the ministry. So there is a separation because in Malaysia, even though whatever you draft, you have to bring to cabinet by the law minister. So that the other relevant ministers who are also drafting their portion of law to be brought to parliament to discuss it among the cabinet ministers. So there are certain SOPs done by different government. I don't know how this prime minister with this coalition government does it, but before, that was how it was done. Now, the element here is a lot of people forget is the element of biasness, because if you draft, would you want someone to criticize your drafting? So that's why in some countries, the drafting division is independent. If you come from one source, you may be like, it's okay, you know, maybe this is what we mean. We have to start there, start somewhere.
And in some ways, when we talk about those draftsmen and implementing policies and laws, in some ways, they act as almost a second opposition to the government of the day. When we look at, you know, their roles of vetting the laws and making sure that their quality, they're up to date and those kinds of things.
But in the drafting division, it's a government agency. There may be an element of biasness, but I'm not sure. But my point is, if it's under the parliament per se and it's really independent, which I've been mooting this idea for so long, I've been saying this all the time, it must be independent. Not only the Parliament Services Act, so that the parliament staff you know, if you look into the British parliament, for example, you know, it's a whole setup on its own. Coming in with the drafting division itself, then it's much easier for the MPs to come forward and say, well, you know, I understand the policy, but the way the wording, I'm not really happy with. And then the NGOs can come in, civil society, INGOs, of course, civil society, CSOs comes in, and everyone has an opinion, and you can talk about it. And this is our whole process of making law. For me, personally, this is my personal view, not my party. My personal view is that if we're really serious in being transparent and being fair, and we want more accountability, we must start with the lawmaking process.
Now, you mentioned bipartisanship just now, which has, I think, popped up, you know, a lot more often since the UNDI 18 bill was first passed. And you've been working with MPs from across the aisle, including YB Hanayo, YB Nuruliza. Why is it important for you to work with the other side? I mean, what does bipartisanship mean to you as an MP?
Well, I think if I go back into when you talk about election, I always believe that if an MP is offering him or herself, there are two key elements. I mentioned a quote about Winston Churchill, but let me just remind everyone is that before it was a single party government by Barisan Nasional.
For a long time.
For a long time. So when you vote for that person, you assume that the party is controlling the government. With a coalition government, the party doesn't necessarily control the government, because what happens now, you start out with a minority party controlling the majority, and now the minority becomes a majority. So the voters get confused. So every election, when the voter vote for an MP, of course the voters have expectation. Number one, my constituency issues. But when an MP offers him or herself, you cannot deny the fact that the MP must carry the voice of their party. And some of their parties may agree or disagree on certain policies. So a coalition government allows the MPs to cross the floor. For example, if you really dare, when you vote on certain policies by the existing government. That's why I've said many times in all my write-up on coalition government, it usually doesn't last more than 22 months. Because you may be similar on your race and your religion, but your ideology may be different, especially when you interpret certain policies. So your policies on, for example, your policies on income, your policies on employability, your policies on women, your policies on rights may differ. And I can sit with Hanayo or Nuriza and talk about prison reform, but maybe they have a different view when it comes to the concept of democracy. I don't know. I haven't touched that yet. We may sit together when we talk about women issues, right? Things that affect them affect us in my party. But not necessarily, I don't know how her party feels or their party feels. But not necessarily. So, but what I'm trying to say is that when I say this, I have to put a caveat because I'm quite fortunate because my party, UMNO, no matter how conservative people say they are, they're not really that conservative because you can still argue and debate with the leadership. And I think that's very important, especially for women. For me, I personally believe that when the vulnerable group or the minority group is in any political setup or a coalition setup and you're allowed to engage, to have a discourse, to continue have a conversation, that is the very key element for the political party to survive. But if the political party are run by sensitivity, run by misogynistic personalities, run by angry personnel, run by paternalistic policies, I think, you know, it's going to short-live itself. So I'm proud to be in BN, in UMNO, although not many people are happy. But I think you must give credit because you've done quite a good job. I mean, to be very, very fair, we made mistakes. We are learning from it. But we do come out as a successful setup. So when you tell me about bipartisan, I don't have an objection for my own political party. My party seniors are not getting sensitive about me communicating or having intellectual discourse. So for me, having a conversation doesn't mean that I support you. But for issue-based, for causes-based, if you have to work together for the sake of the nation and your voters, I think there's no harm in doing it.
On that note, we do need to go for a very quick break. I'm speaking today from Parliament with Dato' Sri Azalina Othman Said, Deputy Speaker of the Dewan Rakyat and Pengerang MP. We'll be back with more on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Hazra Lashraf from Parliament today. It's a special interview as Parliament continues to be out of session, but I'm catching up with Dato' Sri Azalina Othman Said in her office, the Deputy Speaker of the Dewan Rakyat and Pengerang MP. Thanks again for having me in your office today, Dato' Sri. Let's talk about young people because young people are inevitable. They're the future of our country. They've been in the news a lot lately, and youth issues will be at the front and center of the next general election. What sort of legacy or example would you like to set as Deputy Speaker, as an MP, right, to set the tone that Parliament is a place for all Malaysians and that young Malaysians have a place at the table and that their concerns can be heard in a safe space?
Well, you talk about young people. I've got a 19-year-old at home. Tell me about it. I think, to be very, very fair, they're very lucky. I mean, no matter what you say, you know, we didn't come to where we are because we are a nation that came out from a war. And there are so many countries out there still facing war. And you know, when it comes to war, the vulnerable group are always women and children. In our country, we have multiple race and religion, and we are continuously very, very careful when we touch on certain sensitive subjects. But for a country that we gained our independence since 57, we're not that bad. You know, I mean, of course, people want things to be better. When you talk about young people, I think when Undi 18 was put forward at the Pakatan Harapan time, there was a lot of excitement because everybody believed that, you know, young people are able because they are much, much more smarter now than when I was 18 years old, I believe. You know, they know where they're going and every day they are getting smarter. You know, I get my daughter telling me about, there's a lot of new twangs out there. You know, I don't understand. Sometimes, you know, she always believes the fact that I'm very backdated. But I think I'm not that bad. But that's how they are, you know. Sometimes you see, come on, let's bounce. Like, what do you mean by bounce? Bounce means you go. Okay. Can you imagine me in Parliament saying to all the MPs, okay, everyone, YB, let's bounce. I think they'll be very, very pissed with me, right? But the point I'm trying to say is that, yes, the world is changing. And the world is not only changing, it is getting smaller. Now, no matter how a government tries to block the whole conversation on democracy, for example, whatever, you can't bypass it. And I think the Minister of Communication have confirmed, whatever you do, you can have the fantastic laws on fake news. It can enter from outside, and it's borderless. And that's why one of the biggest challenges when I was the Minister of the Law, the Minister in charge of law, was the dark web when it came to children, sexual offences on dark web, on pornography. I mean, that was a huge cry. the point in hand is that it happened, and now things are changing. Kids are getting smarter. We're using the smartphone to educate children, and then you can monitor again, my sejahtera, you know, whatever you do, everybody wants to know. Exactly what George Orwell said in 1984, Big Brother watching you. Now it's not only Big Brother, Big Sister, Big Mother, Big Father, everyone's watching you now, right? There's no freedom. I'm just joking. It's a Ramadan joke. The point I'm trying to emphasize is the fact that you can't run away from them. You can delay the young people coming in. You can run and you can hide because they're coming in fast. So I believe that the best way for any government, especially during this COVID period, should take that into consideration and prepare the young people to understand. One of the things that I've always been consistent is about keyboard warriors. I always believe that if you have something to say, you got to put your face to it. I do that all the time. I don't hide behind a certain personality online or, you know, a tweet that doesn't look like me and call it something else. Because I think you have to be accountable to what you say. And you have to stand to what you believe. And I think this is what young people should do. Do not stop being keyboard warriors. Or if you want to be, put your face there. And it doesn't matter whatever hashtags out there. I mean, for the past few days, there's so many hashtags coming.
A lot of hashtags.
That's my personal view. Again, it's not my party view.
Last year, you wrote, you tweeted, speaking of social media, you tweeted a series of threads on Twitter entitled The Making of a Sustainable Coalition. And this was before you were deputy speaker. I mean, what did you write that, your arguments? What point were you trying to get across, and how does it relate to the situation now?
Well, being a lawyer, we got called to the bar in 1990s. Usually lawyers, we never, ever, usually buy a house that's not ready. We don't buy a house from what the developer offers us because anything can and will go wrong. Lawyers are just like that, a bit sticker. So I never agreed on any coalition government without an agreement. I was not part of it. And I think I wrote that very clearly. It's wrong. Because, again, two key elements. Number one is the voters' loyalty. Because it's been proven in many countries, the voters get confused. And today, not only the politicians are confused, but the voters are going to be confused. They don't know who are they really supporting. And that is not really good for my party, my personal view. I may be wrong. Number one, there was no written agreement, and I don't understand. I've been continuously asking to reset the relationship and asking for another a relationship, resetting it with a written agreement, but nobody's responding, I'm talking to the wall. But I think that would have really assisted us for now, because then it would have been clearer who's in charge of what, what's your exit clause, is there a sunset clause? You know, so all that I would have, if I was in charge, I would have put in. But I wasn't a chair for the legal task force then, because it never existed. Now it does exist, for Barisan Nasional, of course. So that is one thing that I find that I was quite concerned, and it's proven true. And I've said that many times to many people, they will never last more than 22 months. And it's been proven to be true in most countries. Even in UK itself, with David Cameron and Nick Clegg, it took a very difficult tasking. And they had a huge bundle of agreement. They were signing before, after, and they had the pre-coalition election agreement, and then they have the grand coalition agreement, multiple agreements. And again, you know, it couldn't last that long. And one of the things that I emphasized was that if we have been a single-party government, the party's been controlling the government, and now we are sharing to control the government, it is a big no-no for most political parties because the parties doesn't get feedback. And one of the challenges in my party today is that the party hierarchy or the party leaders are not in government. We're not like the other coalition partners, whereby their top 10s and top 15s are in the government ministry, and they're managing the country. So maybe what they make a decision, the party accepts because the party understands when they explain. In our case, unfortunately, it's like a two separate entity, rightly or wrongly. Well, we have certain hybrid there, but the point here is that I'm just talking from my article. I'm not siding whichever faction. I'm not. I'm just emphasizing that the reason why I wrote was because I believe, and I had a sense that the coalition will break up and my party will be affected. Because you must understand, the best analogy I gave was a joint venture agreement between two
companies,
or three, four companies, between the minority shareholders, the majority shareholders. And it's very great common sense that usually those with the bigger share controls. But in what happened was that the smaller one with the smaller share is now slowly doing a reverse takeover.
Is the lack of, you know, a written agreement, a signed contract, do you think that's very much affecting policy making and the ability
of
people to...
Because yeah. even as a single party government, we were running the country way back since independent. We believed that the party was controlling the government because we were allowed to continuously engage. But unfortunately, the rules of engagement wasn't in play. But when I wrote those articles, if you check, I emphasized so much, not only for a post-cabinet meeting with party rep, I also insisted on the pre-cabinet. Cabinet meeting was every Wednesday, say, for example. I thought that the best way was to take in the party rep for maybe a caucus group from each political party to sit in pre and post. Because when you do that, then when you implement a policy, the acceptance and the understanding is much clearer. That's what I had in mind. So that's when I wrote the article. But unfortunately, I don't know how many people, you know, read my article or how many people understand my article. But as what I have estimated, it makes it very, very difficult. My sense tells me with PRU15, it will still be a coalition government. My sense tells me the voters may vote on personality base, may not be on party base. And my sense tells me that it will be a grand coalition. But again, I'll still caveat this statement by saying as long as we do not have an anti-hopping law, this conversation that you're having with me, it could be in a box of a reality check. Because one of the things that I do see is that in a Westminster system, it's not like one man controls everything. What happens is that if you keep jumping and then you bring the whole voters with you, it's going to make the coalition... Really, shake.
How can the government, you know, explore the possibility of introducing laws to regulate politics when parliament is suspended, like now, right? When MPs aren't sitting. I mean, everyone wants to move our country forward. Talking about hashtags, a lot of Malaysians have been, you know, hashtagging Kerajaan Gagal on Twitter. That's been trending. And I think that reflects some MPs from Pakatan have called it the hangover effect. Malaysians are tired. You know, what can be done on that front to regulate politics, to also move our country forward?
Well, I think one of the key elements right now, you know, Israel is the, I always believe, I mean, this is Ramadan month. We must really have this sense of belief that our niyat, our intention is very, very important. If whatever we're doing is just because we want to secure power and more power, you know, we will not get blessing from God. That's my personal view. I think to get from point A to point B right now, if you talk to me about the future, is that we have to engage everyone. And I think this is what COVID is teaching us. Because it's the same thing. Right? I've always give this in my analogy of being a lawyer. When I come up with misogynistic personalities who tries to be, you know, funny when it comes to the way you look, your sexuality, or the way you speak. You know, I always say that if you are facing a death sentence, does it really bother you how your lawyer looks like and from which race, from which religion? Or the same argument goes, if you're having a heart surgery and the best doctor in the world is someone who is not from your race or your religion, someone who doesn't suit into your idea of a right gender, I don't know, would you still go to that person to save your life? The majority may say, yes, we don't care, we just want to save our life. So there's the same argument that I want to apply today to answer your question is that it's not so much about holding the executive accountable. It's about holding the people accountable. I think for the voters, the frustration is that they want the country to move on, yeah? For the voters and for the people. And we have been a country that's always been up there, and we've been a country. But I think COVID is giving us a different kind of variables. So what I believe is that I would ask for a stand down. I would bring everyone to the table from both sides of the aisles, for or against government. Maybe the speaker can chair this unofficially. Really sit down and have a wish list. And have a stand down that, you know, no one's going to throw anyone out. Agree on a fixed term agreement. Start on the hopping. Talk about political donation fund act. Talk about maybe touch on the constituency development funding.
Yep, the allocations.
Whereby everyone gets something when it comes to basic protection, basic needs. Stand down. And look into, okay, let's take this country for a few more months. And then, you know, not look into a grand coalition, but come up with a certain principle that Because right now, everyone believes that they are better in governing. You didn't do a good job, we're doing a good job. Or we've now got COVID, so we have to do it this way. But maybe if you get everyone to sit in, to really sit down and look at the present and the future, but for the people, as this is government for the people, by the people, you know, really sit there, really sit down, and not only be at the table and really speak as clear as we can, and not have this fearful of thinking that parliament is a reverse coup d'etat, and maybe that can get us from point A, B, C, D, E, F, I think the whole alphabet. But nevertheless, I still would want to emphasize that one of the things that I observe is there is no trust from all sides. There's a lot of feeling of uneasiness, that whatever. I think to be very, very fair to the government, I believe that some of the ministers are trying their very best to do, to get on with their job, to really do, to be very, very fair. Now, I'm not on any personality, but I think they are really trying their very best. And they are working hard towards it. But unfortunately, we are facing a very critical community right now is because of COVID. And COVID makes a lot of people very, very uneasy, angry, uncomfortable. It's not only in Malaysia, but the whole world. Simple things like, you know, income earners, you can't earn income, people can't go out and purchase, women, children, the vulnerable group, you know, the whole world has been talking about this for almost a year and a half. So this is, the challenges are not new, these are all challenges. So the point is that if you ask me, what is the way forward, is that we have to get our house in order. You know? I think there must be a lot of housekeeping being done. And everyone who believes that they can do something good for the country should be able to offer their services. I believe there's a lot of leadership out there. Political leadership has got their own strengths and weaknesses. I think everyone out there, I will not mention names. I think everyone. And if you mention names, I would say, yeah, each of them have their own strengths and weaknesses, and each of the political party have their own strengths and weaknesses. And maybe this is what exactly what the people are waiting for. You know? Enough of musical chair. Even I'm tired. You know? I'm a politician and I'm really tired of it. Because I'm so confused. Even I'm confused. Why I'm confused is that at the end of the day, the people out there are waiting to see that this COVID is something that no matter how we want and not want to accept it, it will still be there. So what do we do next? I think the schools need to be open. The children need to go to school. If it's not open, what's plan B? So I hope the politicians out there is able to really, as I mentioned again and again, to be really able to sit down. But if it's a fishing expedition, yeah, it's a red herring application, and it's about going after everyone who has an opinion, and you want the people just to listen to you, make you paternalistic, and your intention is so important, whatever you say or do is right because you're a government, and no one should question you, and whoever is questioned is considered enemy of the state, I think you have to do a reality check. Because I think the whole world is facing the same problem. Look at Trump. He was so popular. And in the end, the people just didn't want him. Why? Because he couldn't handle what was expected. So however great a government is, only time will make that decision later on. So what I'm saying, trying to emphasize, is that you cannot walk alone. You can't do it alone. You need everyone out there, especially Malaysians, to come out and help. You know, like the numbers of being vaccinated, people not trusting the vaccine. How do we get it right? How do you communicate it right? So basically what I'm saying is that to go the way forward, we need to do our own checklist.
I have to ask you this, because just now you mentioned that, you know, without a proper agreement, a written contract between, you know, parties of a coalition, that you don't think that a coalition would, you know, last more than 22 months. And the way things are headed, it seems that things are going, you know, going towards a snap general election, snap polls. Are you ready for elections?
Yeah, of course I'm ready. I've been ready since day one. but I think my personal view is that if there is an election, it must be a fair election. And if there's an election, not only fair, it must be a safe election. And last but not least for me, I hope and I believe and I would want to see every political party walk the talk. If you promise the women more seats, you got to be fair. Don't take it away. Allow. I mean, it's not provided legally it's 30%, everyone talks about 30%, that should be the first commitment. You must allow women to be out there, for example. You talk about young people, that means the decision of the government for the day. But at the end of, I think every political party must look into the mirror and see that the change must start within them. And this is the problem with us. We want the country to change, we want the people to change, but are we changing as a political party? Are we able to take criticism as a political party? Our ideology may have to change. Our vision may have to change. Our mission statement, our strategic direction must change. Before we end, my biggest, not say upsetness, but disappointment with this COVID is data. I've been saying all the time, there's no data out there. It's so difficult to get data. So for me, you know, if I want to make a policy decision as government, or I want to have, if I want to make a statement in my constituency, I need data. I need to know. I need to know and I need to understand what's out there. It's like, you know, most companies, any companies that's selling consumer goods, it's not surveys they do. And those are the surveys that help them to make a strategic direction. Even, I heard even chocolate companies is cutting down on sugar because everyone's not going to eat fattening chocolates, right? Mm. For whatever reason. But the point here is that maybe they're shifting. Everyone's shifting. So what I'm saying is that maybe political parties should also understand that you have to attend to what the mass market is looking at, the majority, the people, the voters. It cannot be an inclusive, it's all about you. You cannot be so narcissistic, it's all about me, myself, and I. Because if you do that, that's when the political party fails. For any political party to go forward, the priority and the focus must be by the members and the people out there. Because when the people vote for us, there's a lot of hope that they put for us. Because that's what our system is all about. But when we don't deliver what we promise, then you make the people not believe in the system that we have put in place way back since independence. That's my 2 cents worth.
And I think the part on women, you know, more women MPs is certainly overdue. Now, just to wrap up, Dato' Sri, you've taken the COVID vaccine already. How are you feeling and what would you like to tell Malaysians, you know, to encourage them to get vaccinated?
Well, I think it's just like a flu vaccine. You know, when I go for my Umrah and Haji, you know, you have to get certain vaccine.
Yeah.
It's an SOP. You don't get that. You can't travel. And then what I did was that I came back. You know, of course, you keep following still different people, different reaction. For me, I was jumping up and down to the gym, rowing the kayak the next day because I never let that feeling of uncertainty affect me. So for me, you know, being vaccinated is something I believe that it's good and I believe in it. And I think a lot of people should, especially when you're getting older.
Dato' Sri, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much. Salam Ramadan again. And if I don't see you, Selamat Hari Raya.
Yes, and Salam Ramadan to
all the viewers out there.
I've been speaking today with YB Dato' Sri Azalina Othman Said, Deputy Speaker of the Dewan Rakyat and Pengerang MP, right here from her office in Parliament. We caught up on her time as Deputy Speaker so far and the current state of politics in our country. If you missed any of today's conversation or previous Live and Learn episodes, check out our podcasts on the BFM app or on our website at bfm.my. Once again, I'm Hezrul Ashraf, and this has been Live and Learn on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.